next case for the record is Guillermo Renteria Novoa versus State of Nevada. Forgive me if I mispronounced the name. Case number 61865. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Justice Hardesty, Justice Douglas, Justice Cherry, counsel for the state, may it please the court. My name is Mike Feliciano, and I work for the Public Defender's Office, Clark County, and I represent Guillermo Renteria Novoa. At this point, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Renteria Novoa has raised 14 grounds for relief in this case, 13 of which, standing alone, would warrant reversal. However, looking at all of them together, this is a case of cumulative error. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the issue of rape shield. Specifically, Renteria Novoa sought to introduce evidence the complaining witness in this case was pregnant at the time of the allegation. The defense tried to get into this information pursuant to NRS 50.085, the cross-examination statute. However, we were precluded from getting into that. The trial court stated that was a rape shield issue, and that's simply not the case here. What we have here is, this rape shield here does not apply. What we have here is a case of credibility and a reason to fabricate. That's why we were offering that evidence. It was not to show that the complaining witness was promiscuous. Therefore, rape shield doesn't apply in this case, and we should have been allowed to get into that as our theory of defense. That basically gutted Renteria Novoa's theory of defense. The complaining witness in this case made the allegations against Renteria Novoa at the exact same time that she told her mother that she was pregnant. And our theory was that based on her being pregnant as a teenager, she used these allegations to get herself out of trouble. So it's not a rape shield. Based on that, we had no defense. We had to formulate a new defense, and we were basically stuck with a weaker defense, and Mr. Renteria Novoa was ultimately convicted. The second issue I want to raise is that of discovery. Renteria did file a pretrial motion for discovery. In that motion, he did ask for any and all type of immigration benefits that were being received by the complaining witness and or her family. That motion was granted. However, no information was received regarding a U visa, which is an immigration benefit. That was not received until mid-trial, even though we made a specific request in our discovery motion for it.
Counsel, as to that, you received information during the pendency of the trial. You were able to use it, is that correct?
We were able to use it somewhat. However, we were not able to incorporate it into our theory of defense in opening statements. We were not able to properly cross-examine the complaining witness because all we knew was that she had received the U visa and her mother had received a U visa.
Did you ask for a trial continuance at that time? Did you find out about that to explore that more?
We asked for a mistrial based on the discovery violation. That was denied. Now, We couldn't use it in an opening, and as far as cross-examination goes, there are many documents that go along with U visas that are filled out by either prosecuting agencies that I'm aware of. They're generally filled out by the DA's office, police officers, those kinds of agencies. We were not able to get into any of those documents because we had never received them. To this date, we still have not received any documents regarding those. Regarding the U visa. So, when you're a victim of a crime, you can, in certain cases, and you're not legally in the country, you can get a visa and be allowed to stay in the country. That would have been another motive to fabricate, and it would have bore on the complaining witness's credibility, that she could have made allegations up in order to get a visa. And to not allow us to get into that, basically undermined our theory of defense. We did have reason to believe that she did have a U visa or was getting one, that we had information from confidential sources that's privileged, and that's why we asked to get into it. We knew about it, and they didn't provide it. Therefore, this is error, and this case should be reversed based on that. The next issue I'll cover is that of prosecutorial misconduct. In this case, there were three instances specifically in the record and that we briefed where we talk about prosecutorial misconduct. First, Renteria's age and appearance was disparaged by the prosecutor. We objected at trial. That objection was overruled. Next, the prosecutor disparaged the defense. The defense theory in this case was consent. They disparaged that defense as basically being, as quote, ridiculous. That's in the record at 1412. After the disparaging comments, the prosecutor then proceeded to vouch for the complaining witness. The prosecutor said that, quote, she was a female DA who does this every single day that shows how credible she is. We objected to that. However, there was no ruling on the objection as the prosecutor rephrased her argument. Based on the disparaging of counsel's theory of defense, disparaging of his age and appearance, and the vouching of for the complaining witness, we would ask for reversal.
Could you be a little more specific about disparagement here?
Disparaging? Well, they refer to our defense as ridiculous, our consent.
Well, what about the age and the appearance?
Basically, what the prosecutor said was she was a young, beautiful woman. Why would she want to have sex with that guy? Basically, and that's what she said. Our client is about 50 years old. He's an older man relative to her.
Thank you.
Yes. So they said basically he was, why would she ever want to have sex with him? I mean, we did object to that, and it was overruled. So that's the instances of prosecutorial misconduct that we're seeking reversal on. The next issue is that of Batson. And in this case, there are specifically three instances we can point to where minority panelists were excluded from the jury. First of all, we did show that there was a pattern of racial discrimination. Approximately one-third of the state's challenges were on minority veneer members. Two of the panelists were excused based on their language difficulties. That was the claim. However, those are merely a pretext for excusal based on race. Here, some of the reasons that were offered were that the panelists could not comprehend the proceedings. In fact, in one case, the district court asked the state if they wanted to voir dire the panel member to see if they could understand or had any issue with them, and they declined. So these jurors were rehabilitated, and they did say they could follow the law, and they understood what was going on. One did need an interpreter. However, he did, at the end, say he did understand what was going on, and he could be fair, and he could judge the case. Another panelist was removed. The reason they give is basically they call her dishonest because at the beginning of voir dire, the trial court asked her if anyone close to her had been a victim of a crime. She stated that her son was the victim of attempted murder. Later, during individual voir dire, she stated that, yes, she knew two people that were complainants in sex abuse cases. However, she was not close to them. So that was not a lie. The state characterizes it as these people were close to her. They were sex abuse complainants, and she did not disclose it to the trial court. At the beginning, therefore, they had an issue with her. Again, another pretextual reason for excusal. These three prospective jurors were stricken due to race. This is a violation of Batson, and this does warrant reversal of this case. The next issue that I'll discuss is jury instructions. And we have a lot of jury instructions here that we had an issue with, as demonstrated in the brief, but I will try to focus just on a few that I have time for. Specifically, instruction 16, that states that the state is not required to prove a specific date but may prove a time frame within the act took place. This is the Cunningham instruction. In Cunningham, we have a 14-year-old complainant who was recalling abuse that occurred 5 to 6 years prior. Here, however, we had an adult complaining witness. She was an adult at the time she testified, who was recalling alleged abuse that occurred when she was a teenager. This instruction did not apply in this case, and it was confusing and misleading to the jury.
Did you propose a counter instruction?
Yes, we did. We actually objected to the instruction as a whole, as being not applying in this case, as I'm saying here today. Instruction 17 comes from LaPierre v. State, and that requires prosecutors to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is some reliable indicia that the number of acts actually occurred. Again, this is another confusing statement to the jury because it simply doesn't make sense. Proof of the alleged acts beyond a reasonable doubt is required. Instruction 17 states that mere conjecture on the part of the alleged victim as to the number of acts is not enough. So this basically implies that something slightly above mere conjecture meets the high standard of reasonable doubt. That simply is not the case. It's confusing to the jury, it's misleading, and it's an instruction that shouldn't have been given. Now, turning to instruction 15, that's the no corroboration instruction. We submitted a proposal that was more complete that asked the jurors to look at all of the evidence in the case, not just to single out the no corroboration part. That instruction was rejected by the trial court, and they gave their no corroboration instruction. And looking at this case in particular, it highlights how unfair that instruction is to the defense. It pulls out one portion of the law from the Axiola, and it states that no corroboration is required for a victim of sexual assault for a person to be convicted of sexual assault. No corroboration is required. The instruction we proposed said they had to look, in addition to that, they had to look at all the other evidence in the case and make their determination whether there was a reasonable doubt or not. So that was a more complete statement of the law. It was a correct statement of the law. It should have been given. This highlights the problem with this instruction, and our alternative instruction should have been given.
Counsel, do you have any comment about the alleged confession?
I do. First, we don't. We don't agree the confession should have come into evidence, first of all, as we filed a motion to suppress, which was denied after a demo hearing. But even with the confession, if taking the confession is true, what Mr. Renteria allegedly confessed to is not what he was charged with. He was charged with conduct under 14 years of age and under 16 years of age. The confession just talked about general conduct with the complaining witness, but it didn't specify a time frame. So it could have been after she was 16, and in that case it would not have been lewdnesses and sexual assault under 14 and 16. So altogether, looking at, I haven't covered a few grounds, I'm running out of time, but altogether in this case, there's so much error, it's simply cumulative. May I finish?
Finish your thought, Mr. Policia.
According to Big Pond, a cumulative error requires reversal, and based on that, we're asking for Mr. Renteria Novoa's case to be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Clark, we'll give him 2 minutes for rebuttal. This is... this case has a lot of issues in it, and provide Mr. McDonald 17 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Brian McDonald for the state. We have our law clerk here, Matt Walker, who participated in the briefing, assisting me today. I want to talk, first of all, just to frame the issues about the theory of defense in this case. And the theory of defense is that he had a consensual relationship with a 12-year-old girl. And the 12-year-old girl was part of this relationship because the defendant allegedly showered her with gifts. And as we know from the confession, this relationship, as it was, from a man who was essentially a father figure for this young girl. The victim's father had died, and so he helped raise her. And we know from the confession that there's a sexual component to this relationship. He says that he was making deals with her in exchange for sex, that he had her show her breasts, that he masturbated in front of her, that he put his mouth on her breasts, and that he touched her vagina. So we know, this is the defense theory, that this was a consensual relationship with a 12-year-old girl. Okay? So let me dig into some of these issues, unless there's a specific direction you'd like me to go in. First of all, I'll just talk about the Batson issue. It's important to note the district court's findings on this because the district court was there and it made certain assessments of which members of the prospective panel were apparent minorities. And it made the comment that because there were so many apparent minorities in the prospective panel, it would be impossible for both sides to avoid striking someone who's an apparent minority. Defense says that racial motivation in support of the Batson claim is proven by the numbers, that 3 of our 9 strikes were directed towards minorities, and thus yielding a one-third proportion, which on its own proves racial motivation. Well, the defense tally is at 4 9ths, because they struck 4 apparent minority members. So, and on the jury, 6 of 14 were apparent minorities, according to the finding of the district court. Defense challenges are a strike of Ms. Martinez, who was the Filipina prospective juror, but in several instances, she indicated, the translation was a little garbly, I would say, but she indicated that she wasn't sure that she could sit in judgment of the case, and the district court agreed with the state in its concerns about this witness. On the flip side, the state had no challenge of Mr. Cordero, who actually sat on the jury and who was a self-identified Filipino. So the racial motivation is not shown by the numbers alone. As to Mr. Aguilar, he said on multiple occasions that he was uncomfortable, he was nervous, and he had a terrible memory. And in fact, he couldn't even accurately recount how many years he had been in the United States. At one point, he said he'd been here 10 years. At one point, he said he'd been here 20 years. The district court also agreed with the state's concern as to this juror in ruling that there was no improper motivation as to the strike. As to Juror Temple, who is the African-American prospective juror. This is the individual who said that she had no experience with victims of sexual assault initially, and then later said, oh, actually, I know a friend, I think, of my son's. I know of two instances, a 5-year-old who I'm pretty sure was telling the truth about sexual assault, and a 16-year-old who I know, because the defendant was acquitted, was lying about the sexual assault. And so that was the basis. That change in position, a lie, or whatever you want to characterize it, it doesn't matter because it doesn't have a racial motivation. And in support of that, we also struck juror Winings, who initially said that he didn't know anyone who had any run-ins with the law, and then, oops, I just remembered I have a son who spent 11 years in prison. So it was the very same basis that we used to strike juror Temple. I'll move on. As to the pregnancy issue, the defense argument here truly is sophistry. Allegedly, the defense position is they want to introduce evidence of this pregnancy. This pregnancy has nothing to do with this crime. There was some confusion initially in the briefings. I think it was unclear if the defendant may have been involved with this pregnancy or this cousin Yahir was involved with this pregnancy. Neither are true. It's completely unrelated. The defense is saying, look, no, when confronted with the rape shield statute, they're saying, no, we're not introducing it to impugn the witness's character. We're just using it to show that she's a liar. And 50.090 says, in any prosecution for sexual assault, the accused may not present evidence of any previous sexual conduct of the victim of the crime to challenge the victim's credibility. I would submit that evidence that you want to get in to show the witness is a liar is a challenge to their credibility in the plain words of the statute. So that was properly denied.
But counsel, the rape shield now seems to be brought in for the denial of this information. Was that appropriate?
Yes, for the reasons I just stated.
They tended to say, and I guess the question is, your recollection of reviewing the record, was there a proffer tendered that way, or was there a proffer tendered, as they were stating, that it was a shift of the focus away from the pregnancy?
The way that they were arguing it is basically that they weren't trying to use it as improper character evidence, as improper propensity evidence to show that she's sexually promiscuous. But the plain words of the statute say you cannot introduce this evidence to challenge a victim's credibility. So they're saying that the motive, the apparent motive to lie, was because she wanted to, you know, if she told her mom that she was pregnant and then in the next sentence said, also, I'm the victim of a sexual assault, all the focus is going to go to the sexual assault. But the victim did not choose the timing of this revelation. The defendant did. The defendant had been harassing, calling, and texting the victim in this case for years. And as she grew older, she grew a little less compliant. And that made him even more angry and even more aggressive. And so there came this instance where he decided to call the cousin. All the previous harassment had been directed to the victim only. But he decides to call the cousin and say, have her call me, and if you don't, I'm going to I'm going to drop this bombshell revelation that's going to ruin her life. And then the cousin says, what's going on? And the cousin's mother, the aunt, is apparently like kind of the matriarch of this family, gets wind of this, and then that's when they confront the victim. So even besides a rape shield analysis, it's not relevant, because they're trying to say that the victim chose the time, and thus it impugns her credibility. That's her motive to lie. She didn't choose the timing of this. She didn't want this out. She was embarrassed about this. In fact, and that's what we proved at trial, that, you know, during her first kind of revelations, as is common with this kind of abuse, it was baby steps. It was, I'm being threatened, I'm being touched, and then this is the way they're touching me, etc. And that's how it unfolds.
How do you defend 36 counts of sexual molestation?
How do I defend
it? How do you defend it when you have an instruction that says, you just give certain time frames? I mean, how do you defend it? Did you need all 36 counts to make sure that you'd convict him?
Are you talking about notice, Justice Sherry?
Well, I'm talking about the fact that the instructions give you a real advantage when you have this where there's smoke, there's fire type thing, where you have to defend on each one of these incidents in time frames of an adult witness, and she's an adult now, testifying as to things that happened when she was a teenager. And it makes it very difficult when you've got this number of counts with that instruction, is what I'm trying to get to. Talking about the jury instructions is really what I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm sorry, which jury instruction?
It would be the one about
the timeline,
number
16?
Yes. Time frame, not specific date, the Cunningham issue. Is this
yes.
really a Cunningham case? Did you need the Cunningham instruction?
Yes, we did. We needed that, and the law provides for that, especially in the cases of child victims of sex assault, because the age of the victim when they become a complaining witness as part of the legal process, I don't think is the focus of the inquiry. The focus of the inquiry is the age of the child when she was the victim of sexual assault.
Those are powerful words, child and victim, and we're talking about she was 12 when this occurred?
She was 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and 16.
And when did she become pregnant?
That's unclear. But if she was pregnant when she was 16. Okay? And, the number of counts are limited by the actions of the defendant. You know, if you look at the Ariel Castro case out of Cleveland, he was charged with 977 counts. And I'm sure that was pleaded as a time frame as well, because it's inherent in these kind of cases where you have habituation and a course of conduct of predation, where this happens over a period of time.
So you're comparing this case to a man who kidnapped three women and held them for a number of years?
I'm comparing this, the analysis of this issue to a similar issue in that case.
Go on.
Okay.
Mr. McDonald, I have a question, sort of a follow-up to the counts that are alleged here. It seems as though some of these counts are redundant. For example, could you comment on whether counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are redundant? Now, there is a bit of a distinction in the allegations made in them, but they appear to relate to sexual activity that's taking place at the same time as all part of a single transaction. Why shouldn't these counts be viewed as redundant?
These counts refer to distinct acts of sexual assault or lewdness.
Mm-hmm.
So the defendant in this case had a established procedure of victimization. And normally there would be some kind of touching or mouth contact with the victim's breast area, thus resulting in the lewdness count. Then there would be a digital penetration of the vagina. Then subsequently there would be a change in position, and there would be an oral cunnilingus count. And then there would be another change in position where the defendant would move the victim from lying on her back to a hands and knees position in order to achieve a digital penetration of the anus and then an oral penetration of the anus. These are distinct acts of sexual assault, and they're distinguishable from the cases that this court has found redundancy in. And I'm talking about Crowley. I'm also talking about, and I don't think this one is briefed, Ebeling, which is 120 Nevada 401. And in Crowley, of course, there was a lewdness and sexual assault charged for touching the victim's penis and for fellatio. But the touching was only in order to achieve a state of arousal that would facilitate the ensuing fellatio. So because that's one course of conduct, they're not distinct, because the purpose of the first is to achieve the second. And the same thing happened in Ebeling, and that was the victim's contact with the cheek of the victim's butt. And then
in transit to achieve the penetration. And because those things are together, they are not distinct. And that is where we can differentiate what happened here. Because it was not as if we charged a lewdness for the facial contact with the vagina and then a sexual assault for the cunnilingus. We charged distinct acts. And so therefore, none of these are redundant.
How many sentences were consecutive in this case?
Four.
But they're all life sentences.
There's two gross misdemeanors. All the rest have life tails. Basically, they structured the sentence so that there was one for each, basically. So a sexual assault, consecutive to a sexual assault under 16, consecutive to a sexual assault under 14, consecutive to the lewdness.
So he'll never get out.
It's a 95-year minimum. Yes.
The Brady issue, the violation?
The U visa issue. The U visa, the state knew nothing about that. The state was not involved in certifying for the U visa. And in fact, it was defense counsel, as Mr. Feliciano said, who had the information about the U visa. We didn't. It was kind of sprung on us because he wanted to question the victim about her possible illegal immigration status when she was a victim of this crime. And then he started talking about the U visa, the court brought the victim in, and out of the presence had to basically, you know, question her and said, did you get any kind of U visa as a result of this case? And she said, yeah, you know, it took my mom a year after these charges, but she eventually went to someone at family court, apparently told her that she might be eligible for a U visa, and so the mother went and sought it out for the mother and the daughter. So that happened in 2011, which is about 15 months after the crime was reported. So it's not a Brady issue in that it's, you know, not material, and it wasn't withheld, you know, because we didn't know about it. You know, we don't know what, you know, Department of Homeland Security is doing or the various agencies who can certify, which include the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So we're not involved in that. The District Attorney's Office is rarely involved in certifying for U visas.
Okay. Any other questions? Anything else you wish to add, Mr. McDonald?
Other than that, I think submitted on the briefs.
Thank okay. You. Mr. Feliciano, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So now basically what we have here is we have the prosecution claiming that they're not responsible for the U visa information. I have no words to describe that. I mean, we asked for that in a discovery motion. We had no access to this complaining witness. They had all the access in the world. This discovery motion was heard months before the trial, at least. I don't remember the exact time frame, but generally they're months before. All they had to do was call her up and ask her, and we could have went from there. And we did not seek to get into her illegal immigration status. That's absolutely untrue. We wanted to get into the U visa to show her motivation and her reason to fabricate. We had no intention of getting into her immigration status. That's absolutely untrue. Regarding theory of defense, the state's characterization of our theory of defense is absolutely incorrect. We did have a consent defense, however, we never had a consent defense that there was consent with a 12-year-old.
Was he found not guilty of some of the counts?
No.
All 36 out of 36?
Yes.
I think I added it quickly.
He was based on everything. Yes.
How did you prepare as far as time frames, knowing what Cunningham says? How did you prepare to defend this man?
Well, we were. That's an interesting issue, and we briefed it. The time frames in this case, they pleaded a 5-year window of time. So, if you look at the record, it's really impossible to tell what count corresponds to what action.
We prepared the best we could under those circumstances, considering we had 36 counts to deal with. This was basically an all-or-nothing type defense.
But when she was on the stand, were you able to try to pinpoint when certain things happened, whether she was 14 and living on so-and-so street, or whether she was 16 living someplace else, or whether she was in school, or whether she was having the baby? Well, you can't go into the baby, but were you able to pinpoint any of this?
The state did. The way they attempted to pinpoint the time frames was based on where she was living at certain times. However, they still pleaded a five-year window. They could have easily narrowed that down based on where she was living at certain times and narrow those counts down.
Well, isn't it the case, counsel, that counts 1 through 11 were all related to events that occurred at University Apartments? And you knew that.
Well, if that was the case, it should have been pleaded where in that time window, not in the 5 years. That gave him way too much leeway to basically throw anything at us that we couldn't defend.
Well, wasn't the testimony at trial identified when she was at University Apartments, when she was at Andover Place, when she was at Southern Cove?
It did, but looking at her testimony, most of her testimony was the prosecutor telling her what had happened and her agreeing. It was not spontaneous. It wasn't her testifying, this happened and this happened. It was more of, did this happen to you at this place? Did this happen to you at this place? Did it happen to you at this place? And those were all affirmative answers. So if, in fact, I may continue. I'm sorry. No, I'm running a little long.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, those counts occurred at the University Apartments, they could have easily pleaded the case to give us some notice that the time frame of whenever she was living there, but they chose not to.
Okay.
This was did you have a preliminary hearing or indictment in this case?
We had a preliminary hearing.
Okay.
Any other questions for counsel?
No.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. This case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until 2:30.